I'm delighted to be here today. I always give this message with fear and trembling, however. It never is easy. And I've already figured out that the reason the Lord has me give it so many times is because I'm the one who needs it the most. And He's made me be reminded many times lately, and it gets more painful each time. So I want you to understand that I don't stand here at all as an expert or as one who has all the answers by any means. But I trust that we can consider what the Lord has to say today and then cry a lot and go see what we can do about it. I trust, as Yvonne invited you to pray, that you did pray, "Lord, open my heart." Because a message like this is never easy. It always shows up our clay feet, and it's always hard to take. So I trust that you're praying right now, "Well, Lord, just let me see things as they really are, and to be honest with myself." You know, everyone is so happy when someone gets engaged, and of course this is the time of year when we're having many engagements, weddings, and there's a great deal of excitement about it. But then it's not long after that couple's married until it's evident that the glow begins to go. And you talk to that same girl a little while after she's married, and unless she's quite unusual, she won't seem nearly as excited about being a wife as she was about being a bride. Divorce rates, of course, are soaring in the United States. And I think we would agree that most of the marriages in our acquaintance are not happy ones. Not really genuinely happy. Many couples seem just to endure one another, but their marriage is at a Mexican standoff, and they're poles apart. They quarrel publicly and privately, tear each other down, and go on just enduring one another. I think there are many reasons for this. First of all, it could be the wrong choice of a partner to begin with. Another reason could be that the marriage wasn't based on love and respect to begin with. Another reason could be this Hollywood concept of marriage. How many has that followed up? And then another reason could be the partners not fulfilling their individual roles. And of course, written over all of this is the fact that Satan is trying desperately to destroy the Christian home, any home, but particularly the home of Christians. If Satan can destroy a home, think how many lives he has affected. And I believe that the Christian home is a prime target area of Satan's arrows and attacks today. Now, probably the reason that I've given that most of us could identify with the most is this one of the partners not fulfilling the role for which they were created. Howie Hendricks says that the greatest problem in contemporary marriage is a blurring of the roles. A blurring of the roles. Now, girls, sometimes in an atmosphere like this, at a Christian conference, it's hard to admit that there are problems. Hard to be honest. Maybe you think because you're sort of a super sparkly Christian that you shouldn't have any problems. Or maybe you think that it wouldn't be very spiritual to admit that there are problems. Or perhaps you feel, "Well, I sought God's will in my marriage, and I know that He brought us together. And if He brought us together, we shouldn't have any problems, should we?" Or maybe you feel, "Well, since I sought God's will, why can't I solve all these?" Others may not have known the Lord when you married. Or if you knew Him, maybe you didn't even seek His will. And so you think, "Well, I'm doomed to a mediocre marriage," or you're fraught with guilt and feel that you're going to live with this the rest of your life. And I think that the big problem in a situation like this in a Christian conference is that you feel like it would be quite unspiritual to admit that there are problems. And so the result is that we wear masks. We're all well acquainted with masks, aren't we? We're taught from the time we're little girls to wear them for every situation. And it becomes so that we don't know who we are. ourselves because we're so used to wearing these heavy masks. And my friend Keith Miller says we get spiritual hernias on our souls from trying to carry these heavy masks. And you know, you wear one with one group and another with another group, and then the groups get together and it gets very confusing, and you get weary with wearing these heavy masks. And this is certainly true in this area of marriage. Well, there are two or three things I'd like to assure you of as we begin. First of all, is this fact that just because a marriage wasn't made in heaven doesn't mean it has to end up in hell. And secondly, not admitting problems doesn't erase them. You know, problems just don't go away simply because you just don't face them. And then thirdly, forget the fact or the thought that it's unspiritual to admit that you have problems. It's more unspiritual and sinful to pretend that all is well and wear a mask. And then fourthly, remember that God cannot forgive sin until we honestly confess it to Him as sin. God can't deal with a problem until we admit there is a problem. And you know, the Bible doesn't say God forgives excuses. The Bible says God forgives sin. And God will heal our marriages if we'll give Him all the pieces. And He will heal a broken heart if you give Him all the pieces. Our God is a Redeemer God, not only in the matter of salvation, but in redeeming us from all that sin has caused in our lives. And you know, God is a Redeemer God for your marriage. He wants to redeem it and make it a glory to His name. And in every situation of life, God is a Redeemer God, and He's always at the business of redeeming our lives. Now, I'm sure, without any question, that most of the problem is with your husband, isn't it? But if he's here today, you don't have to worry. He's really going to get an earful. So you can forget about him. And let's consider the remote possibility that we might be a slight part of the problem today, and just think about us. And I think it would be well if we just considered for a minute the beginning of this whole business of marriage. Where did it all come from? Whose idea was it anyhow? Let's remember that this whole idea began with God. You know, Adam didn't say to God in the garden, "Now look, God." No, God said that He saw that Adam was lonely. It was all God's idea from the very beginning. And do you realize that this is the very first institution that God established? Doesn't that make it special to you? The very first thing in establishing things on the earth that were to be lasting things were important to God. The very first thing in the mind of God was this matter of marriage. I think that's very special. And I think it shows us what was in God's mind. Now, do you suppose He created this to bring us unhappiness, to make it a battleground, to make it as hard as He could? Quite obviously, He didn't. He meant for this to be the most precious of all of Earth's relationships. And yet, for many, it is simply a battleground, isn't it? In fact, it's hell on earth for many. But let me tell you, that's not what God meant it to be. When Jesus Christ came to earth to explain God by becoming God in the flesh, what did He choose as an earthly illustration of the Father's love? What did He use to illustrate how He loved the church? Did He use the mother-son, mother-child, brother-sister? No, the husband-wife. Again, this shows us how important it is to God. In Ephesians 5, it talks about how Christ, as Christ is to the church, so the husband is to the wife. So marriage is very much God's business. And I think you can see then that the only basis for a truly happy marriage is for both partners to be rightly related to God so that they can be rightly related to each other. Now, I know you all can probably point to a marriage and say, "Well, boy, here, my sister or brother or cousin, they don't know the Lord and they have a really happy marriage." But I would say that if you knew the heart of that couple, they're missing out on the depth of happiness. And of course, it would be a rare couple indeed that you could say this about. But the basis for a really happy marriage is both couples being rightly related to the Lord. Now, I think you can see, because of the importance of this mission of marriage, what God started it out to be, you see, why Satan attacks it so much. You can understand why Satan makes it a target area. Because how many marriages are accomplishing today what God appointed them to do? To reflect His love, His deep, deep love for the believer. Satan uses many attacks. Let me just suggest five of them today. Some of you will say, well, that doesn't apply to me. That would never happen in my marriage. But just write them down. It's possible that tomorrow you may need it. 1 Corinthians 10:12 says, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. All right, the first thing he does is appeal to our vanity. You know, especially as we're getting a little older, Satan can make us think, I wonder if I'm as appealing to the opposite sex as I used to be. Perhaps it's while husband is gone on a long trip. Perhaps it's when husband isn't being as attentive as you'd like him to be. And usually Satan sends some rank, godless sinner man into your life. No, he sends someone from your Christian group. Someone who compliments you. Someone who tells you how pretty you look. While your husband is being such a fink and not saying anything. Does it ring a bell with anyone? Satan appeals to our vanity. Second thing he can do is he can say, surely an extramarital relationship would be far more exciting than the one I'm having in marriage. Especially if yours isn't everything you think it ought to be. He can make an outside relationship look very exciting and appealing. Another thing he says or does is to divide the home, and often he divides the home with good things. You know, it doesn't have to be bad to suit Satan's purposes. He looks at the end it accomplishes. Now, we can be divided on going to Christian meetings, can't we? If our children are home alone every night because we're at the church, I think that's sin, ladies. And Satan would love to divide the home where we're never together. Daddy's one place, mother's another, and the children are another. Little league baseballs. You know, sometimes I wonder if it's satanic. Not really, but do you understand what I mean? Anything that divides the home so that we are no longer a unit can really be a tool in Satan's hand. Fourthly, he says to us, oh, surely you don't think the Bible standard still applies to today. Not the old-fashioned Bible standard. Ladies, God hasn't changed his mind one bit. The formula he laid down in the scripture was the perfect formula for sublime happiness on earth. And it's as current as tomorrow's newspaper, and God hasn't changed his mind one single bit. And the last thing is that he gives us this confusion about the proper roles. And we find such a great switching of roles in marriage, and this causes absolute havoc. And since this blurring of the roles is the number one problem, it's what I'd like to talk most about today. Some of this will be just old hat to some of you, but like I said before, I know I personally need to be reminded over and over and over again. And so if it's old hat to you, say, Lord, do I need a reminder? Some of you will be brand new and you won't like it. And you can pray, Lord, open my heart. Now, I personally feel that in a marriage, most of the problems either center in the wife, or at least she's the key to solving them. And I wished I didn't feel that way. It'd be a lot easier. Wouldn't you love to blame your husband for everything? But if you stop to think about it, I believe that you could agree with us that problems in marriage, either we're the center of them, or at least we're the key to solving them. I've put on the blackboard the four things that I think have to do with our wifely duties four roles that we have to fulfill. The first one is the supportive role. The second one is being a loving companion. The third one is being queen of our household. And the fourth one is a sex partner. And these are the four things I'd like to talk about today. First of all, in this supportive role, well, I think the very first thing that we can do to fulfill this role is to acknowledge our husband's role as the head. Ephesians 5, 22 through 25 talks about how as Christ is the head of the church, so our husband is the head of the wife. You know, anything with two heads is a monstrosity, isn't it? It belongs in the sideshow. And ladies, any home with two heads is a monstrosity. Friend husband says it's a sad house where the hen crows louder than the rooster. Genesis 2:18 is often quoted as saying that God made woman to be a help mate 50-50. Have you heard people say this? Our marriage is 50-50. We share and share alike. But ladies, it's not that word at all. It says a help meet, which means a helper meet for him, fit for him, completing him. I love that thought. God has made us a completer. And our husbands are incomplete unless we are completing them by fulfilling the role God has cut out for us. And we don't have a 50% role. We each have a 100% role to fulfill. And it takes both of us to make a happy marriage then. Now some think, well, I'm just as good as he is. I'm certainly as smart. I'm better educated. And today women have equal rights. And besides, I was a sorority girl. And he wasn't. Why should I submit to him? Well, in the first place, we have a wrong understanding of what submission is. Today we have a great deal about women's rights, don't we? Women's lib has moved in. And we hear a great deal about women's rights. Some very wise woman said, having won our rights, we lost our privileges. Which I think is a tremendous statement. In fulfilling this supportive role, the next thing is to be in subjection or submissive to our husbands. And when some women hear this word, they immediately suspect God of favoritism and injustice toward us. Dr. Barnhouse gave a definition, which has been a tremendous blessing to me, about this word subjection or submissiveness. He said the root word carries with it this idea of throwing a foundation under as an assistant. Isn't that lovely? God has given us the privilege of just putting a foundation under our husbands. Now, it has nothing to do with being superior and inferior. It has nothing to do with being a second-class citizen. Not at all. It's simply a difference of roles. But on the same plane, equally loved by the Lord, simply cut out to fulfill a different role that complements each other. Dr. Barnhouse always also said that everyone knows that a woman is superior to a man at being a woman. And a man is superior to a woman at being a man, but a mannish woman and a womanish man is an ugly thing. Proverbs 31:26, in talking about a domineering type person, says this in the Berkeley. She opens her mouth with wisdom and gentle teaching is on her tongue. And the footnote in the Berkeley says, she is not domineering as such an energetic woman often is. It's not a question of superiority or being better. It's just a difference in role. And ladies, if you can settle that in your heart, that will mean a great deal to you. All right, why is it important to submit? For many reasons. It's important because it allows our husbands then to be what God wants him to be. You see, he cannot be what God wants him to be without my support. God calls him to be the head of the family, but a husband cannot become a leader until he has a follower. Now, many of you think, well, if my husband would just lead, I would let him. Do you remember when he tried? Ladies have said to me, well, I let him take over, but then he goofs, and then I take back over again and do it myself. Well, you may have to let him goof, because you see, you may have taken it from him so long, he's forgotten how to be the leader. But he will be a leader if you'll just be a follower. That's what he needs. And ladies, it's a convicting thing to me to realize that I not only hurt myself, but I keep my husband from fulfilling God's role for him. He cannot do God's will for him without my cooperation. Another reason to submit is that it, of course, makes me then the woman God wants me to be. It fulfills my role. And otherwise, frustration is going to result if I try to be anything else. Now let me ask you, have you ever looked at one of the women's libs advocates and thought, oh boy, do I ever wish I could be like her? Have you ever seen anything feminine and lovely, peaceful, content about any of these ladies? Women? I don't think they're ladies. No, because you see, they're going against what God has cut them out to be. They're attacking the home primarily. And I have yet to see one that made me think, oh, wished I could be like that. And if I'm not giving myself to being a woman, a mother, a wife, a woman as God meant me to be, then I'm not fulfilling the role for which He created me. God requires our submission in marriage, ladies, not because He needs it, but because we need it. He knows that this is what will make us the happiest. It's our need, not His. Ephesians 5:22 has another clue to this. It says that we're to be submissive, or one of the translations uses the word adapt yourself to your husbands. Why should I? It gives a very wonderful clue in this verse. Should I do it just for my husband's gratification? You see, here then comes this battle again of, well, I'm just as good as he is sort of thing. But you know what this verse says? It says, adapt yourself to your husband as a service unto the Lord. You see, here's where the real battle is. It's between me and the Lord. And he said, if you submit yourself to your husband as a service unto me, then God will be happy and I will be happy and satisfied. Titus 2:5 in the Phillips gives another very interesting word on this. It says, talks about wives being willing to adapt themselves to their husbands as a good advertisement for the Christian faith. Now, some of you are wondering, how can I witness? How can I witness? How can I share my faith? I don't witness enough. This is one way, isn't it? This says that if we are submitting ourselves to our husbands, adapting ourselves to our husbands, this is a good advertisement for the Christian faith. Now, we understand that as Christians, we respond to Christ's great love by surrendering to Him. We understand this, don't we? We understand that this is a show of our love, a response of love. And in the same way, we recreate this role in marriage, you see. And if a wife finds it difficult to submit to her husband, that same wife is having difficulty submitting to the Lord. Now, don't you wish that wasn't so? I can feel so spiritual about the whole thing and think that my submission to my husband has nothing to do with my spiritual walk, because really I'm so terribly, terribly spiritual. But it's my husband who has the problem. But I think you'll understand from the scriptures that a problem in human relationships is first of all a vertical problem in our relationship with the Lord. Horizontal relationships will never be right, you see. But if I'm submitted to the Lord, then I'll be submitted to my husband. Howie Hendricks says, we have overemphasized submission to husbands and underemphasized submission to the Lord, because submission is the lifestyle of the believer. And if I'm submitted to Christ, then submission to my husband will come. All right, the third thing we can do in this supportive role, this first one's real long, so don't worry about it. The others are short, but this first one. Third thing we can do is to accept him as he is. Don't try and change him. This is still under the supportive role. There's a little poem that says, a maid to a man is a vision ethereal, but a man to a maid is a piece of material. Friend Husband also has another poem about that. You know, the man hopes she'll always stay just as she is, but it's not long till the woman has complete alterations that for plans she'll make on her man, or something like a complete plan for the alterations she'll make on her man. A man to a maid is a vision ethereal. The third point is to accept him as he is. To accept him as he is. And don't try and change him. And there are, I think, four things that we need to do if we're going to learn to accept him as he is. First is to get rid of our own self-righteous attitude. It's because I'm so good, you see, that I can look at him and want to change him. Isn't that true? Get rid of my own self-righteous attitude. Secondly, look to his better side. Now, I bet some of you forgot he ever had a better side. You have so long been trying to change him that you've forgotten. And ladies, let me just insert this, that any woman who succeeds in changing her husband to what she wants him to be has made him less than a man and hates what she has created. A woman who is domineering and who manages to manipulate and change her husband ends up with a caricature and not a man, and she hates what she has created. Have you ever seen a domineering woman who is the boss, who is happy? Have you ever seen a man who loves being married to that woman? No, because you see, it just doesn't work. The third thing we need to do to accept them as they are is don't use other men as a shining example. Have you done this? Do you know what Bob does for Yvonne? Well, every night he does something. Don't use other men as a shining example. Do you know that Jerry's husband helps her with the dishes every night? Ooh, that's easy to do, isn't it? And then fourthly, express your acceptance. Sometimes we think these big, old, rugged husbands of ours who fight all the tigers in the world don't need to hear a soft and gentle word from us that says, honey, I love you, and I'm just glad you're just the way you are. But they need to know by our actions and by our words that we accept them. Now, they fight the tigers all day, and they're not accepted in the world just with open arms. They have to fight, you see. But when they come home, they desperately need to hear from you that here is one who loves them and accepts them just the way they are. All right? The fourth thing you can do in supporting him is to become interested in him. And self-centeredness is what keeps us from being interested in him. Pretty easy to get wrapped up in my little world, isn't it? Especially when you're home all day and you've got dustpan and dishes and babies and diapers and so on. But he needs us to be interested in him. We wound our husbands most frequently by just indifference. Now, some of you say, well, boy, my husband just never talks to me. Could it be because of indifference? Could it be that he tried to talk to you and you were so indifferent that he finally quit? Charlie Shedd, in his book, Letters to Caring, said that it is seldom sex that drives a man to a mistress. Now, isn't that your first thought when a man takes a mistress, that it's for sex? Shedd says, it is seldom sex that drives a man to a mistress. It is rather her ability to make him feel like a king. And then he tells the illustration of a man in his church who was married and had a family and was an officer, elder or something in the church, prominent man, good business, you know, the whole bit. And this man suddenly just upset everyone by announcing that he was divorcing his wife, leaving his family, his church, his job, his home, moving to another town to marry, of all things, the elevator girl in his office. Well, of course, the whole church was really shook up. And the man came to Charlie and he said, Charlie, I don't expect you to condone it or to understand it, but I just want to tell you how it happened. And then he told this story. He said that every morning when he came to work, this little girl on the elevator smiled and had a happy word for him. Wanted to know when he came down at noon or at night, how did his day go? always had a smile, always was interested in him. And for this, ladies, he was willing to give up honor, prestige, church, home, family, town, everything, for a woman who loved him and who showed it and who cared about him. And your husband needs very much to know that you care about him. And making him feel like a king will be your greatest insurance against a mistress ever being a problem. Howie Hendricks also says that you must have a very strong magnet in your marriage, or there will be a strong magnet pulling outside of your marriage. All right, another thing we do is to encourage and support them in every way. Dr. Barnhouse says that we're not to be a mere brush fire, giving off a little warmth, but moving in too many outside activities. Rather, the Christian wife is to be a hearth fire, radiating the warmth of love and tenderness where a man may find asylum from the cold world in which he works. What are you to your husband? Are you a little brush fire, giving off a little warmth here and there, but moving in too many outside activities? Or are you that hearth fire that he comes home to? One way we encourage our husbands is simply by listening to him. A friend of mine said that her husband said, "You know, would you bring your coffee and come in here? I'd like to talk to you." And she said, "Oh, could I bring him in?" And he said, "No, I would just like to talk to you." Do you sometimes feel that to sit down and talk, you've got to have something in your hands? Got to be repairing, mending, you know, redeeming the time? Well, the best way we can redeem the time is to give our husbands our undivided attention when he wants it. Are you interested in his work? Are you interested in his ideas? Proverbs 31:12 in the Amplified says, speaking of the godly woman, it says she will comfort, encourage, and do him only good as long as there is life within her. Don't you like that? That's quite a challenge. She will comfort, encourage, and do him only good as long as there is life within her. And 1 Corinthians 13:7 in the Living New Testament says, when you love someone, you will always be loyal to him. You will always believe in him. You will always expect the best of him, and you will always stand your ground in defending him. Isn't that good? That's a good verse to write as a little goal for your marriage. All right, another thing we can do is to pray for him, to support him. Now, not just, "Lord, bless old John today," but to pray with wisdom and with understanding and with insight. Now, Satan is out. That must have really touched someone. Satan is out to get the man of God. And ladies, our husbands face temptations we will never know. They face harder temptations than we'll ever face. And I think that it is only wisdom to pray and guard them. Pray defensively. Pray against pride, against lust, against money. Now, some of you are thinking, "Well, my husband is such a dear Christian, and we're so devoted, and we're doing Bible study every week, and he's memorizing 3 verses a week, and so this would never be a problem to him." Well, girls, let me just remind you that it's the one who is closest to the captain in a battle that gets the most of the enemy's arrows. And you need to be guarding your husband, praying defensively for him. Praise God if he's a godly man. But he'll stay that way as you pray for him and hold him up. Do not take it for granted. Speaking to an older lady one day, a relative, telling her how I prayed for Gene when he was traveling, and I think she was quite abhorred to think that I would even mention these things out loud to the Lord, because I told her I prayed against lust and women and so on. And I said, "Oh, it's not that I don't trust my sweetheart. I trust him anywhere with anyone. But I don't trust Satan, and I don't trust those dollies he dresses up. And I think I would be ignorant and stupid to not hold my husband up in prayer, praying defensively against the problem of lust. If you have a husband who travels, I hope you are holding him up in prayer. If you have a husband who works with a bunch of cuties down at the office, I hope you're holding him up in prayer. Do you see what I mean, ladies? Wherever he is, he needs your support, your prayer. If he's in a counseling situation, pray all the harder. How many Christian men have gone down the drain because of a counseling situation with a woman? Many. And it could be your husband, and it could be mine, you see. Keep him second only to the Lord. This is the last point. Keep him second only to the Lord. As a Christian wife, I think we have five priorities. One is, first of all, our relationship to the Lord. Secondly, our relationship to our husband. Thirdly, to our children. Fourthly, our home. And then fifthly, or shall I call it service, which could be spiritual, PTA, social. Now, I don't know about you, but number five jumps up into first place very often, or into second place where my husband's supposed to be. Pressure to do good things. Well, if I don't do it, nobody else will. Sort of thing. But if, ladies, if I'm neglecting my walk with the Lord, if I'm neglecting my husband, my children, or my home, then I have no business doing these other things. Now, the work of the church and God's work would not suffer one bit if every woman took these priorities to heart. Some of you think, if I didn't do it, you know, these 14 jobs I'm doing in the church, if I didn't do it, the church would fall apart. Ladies, if every lady considered her priorities before God and ordered her life by those, the church of God would prosper as it never has before. There would be no lack. And furthermore, there would be fewer children on their way to hell today because of mothers who have driven them away because they have not maintained their own priorities. I don't know about you, but I know in my own life that if I'll just go back and check this list of priorities, I can pretty well figure out what's wrong. And if there's a question about whether I should or shouldn't do something, if I'll just go back and check my priorities, I usually have the answer. There's no success in life to compensate for failure in the home. The Amplified Old Testament, Proverbs 31:16, says this: she considers a new field of interest or activity before she buys or accepts it, expanding prudently and not courting neglect of her present duties by assuming others. With her savings of time and strength, she plants fruitful vines in her vineyard. And to me, that fruitful vines in her own vineyard means my own children, my own home. All right? Secondly is, what makes us a loving companion? And I think I can best describe this by telling what makes us unlovable. First thing I think that makes a wife unlovable is being nagging, a nagging wife. Nag, nag, nag. A friend of mine said to her husband, "Honey, what do you mean by nagging? How would you define nagging?" He said, "When you ask two times." Proverbs 21:9 in the Amplified has this to say about a nagging wife. Now, this will really hurt your feelings. "It is better to dwell in the corner of a housetop on a flat oriental roof exposed to all kinds of weather than to be in a house shared with a nagging, quarrelsome, fault-finding wife." Nagging. Now, those of you who know my husband understand that I don't really have a whole lot of problem nagging him. He's not really the type you nag. But do you know who I nag? I nag my two little boys. I think this is one of those qualities that unfortunately comes very naturally to women. We are naggers by nature. And it only is the Lord who can take this out of us and keep us from being naggers. Another thing that makes us unlovely is being very negative and critical. This is another thing that I think women especially, this is a disease among women. It comes so naturally. I come from a very long line of negative, critical thinkers. Fear comes very easy to me. And friend husband has something he says to me when I get bogged down in this type of thinking. He hasn't said it for a long time, but I hope he doesn't have to for a long time. We were at a gift shop one time over in Greece, and do you know the type of vases and things that come out of Greece? Well, it's not my bag, you know. I'm not really crazy about them. And he would say, "Isn't that lovely?" And it'd be some Grecian urn or something, you know. And I said, "Ooh, I think it's awful." And then the next thing, you know, I said, "Oh, look at that. Isn't that attractive?" And I said, "Oh, I think it's ugly." And, you know, this went on for a few minutes. And finally he said to me, "Honey, sun coming up in the west in the morning?" When he says that, I get the point, you see. And I know it's time to start thinking positively. Being very negative and critical. How many a wife does this to her husband? I've been with wives that had nothing positive to say, just negative, pessimistic, negative, critical. Proverbs 12:25 says, "Heaviness in the heart of man maketh it stoop, but a good word maketh it glad." Does your husband's heart stoop because all he hears from you is negative words? Are his shoulders beginning to stoop? You better check and see. You may be the cause. A third thing is being a dream buster. This makes us most unlovely. Now, ladies, the world will bust your husband's dreams, but he needs you to support him. When he comes home and says, "Oh, I've got the keenest idea. I've got this idea for an invention." What do you say? Do you say, "Oh, good night, that would never work"? Or you'd say, "Now, where do you think we'll get the money for that?" Or do you say, "I read that in Woman's Day 4 months ago"? Or do you say, "Oh, well, Jean's husband does that all the time. It's nothing new"? Ladies, are you a dream buster? You know, if you are, it's an unlovely characteristic. Now, you may have to pray about some of those dreams, but support him. God will get to him if it's a bad dream, but don't you bust his dream. Fourthly, something that makes us unlovely is to be filled with self-pity and complaining. Self-pity. When you're a young wife, you're filled with self-pity because you're stuck at home with the kids. Your husband has this glamorous job and wears glamorous clothes and meets all these glamorous people, and you're stuck with hair hanging in your face, scrubbing the floor, and so on. And then when the king comes home at night, he wants to sit down and read the paper, and you've had the kids all day, and you just want to throw them at him and say, "Take them!" And so you're filled with self-pity. When you're older, you're filled with self-pity, maybe because your kids neglect you. They have their own lives. But again, this is a women's disease, isn't it? To be filled with self-pity and complaining. Jude 16 in the Berkeley starts out this way. "These are the grumblers complaining of their lot." And I think this is so unlovely. In me, I see it so much. And do you know what I hate in my children? I hate these things that I see in my children. And you know why I hate them? Because I see me in them. And when I see the things that I am weak in being reflected in my children, I wish I could shake it out of them, you know. It really affects me to see this being reproduced in my children. And ladies, unfortunately, we do this, don't we? All right, another thing that makes us unlovely is just simply talking too much. Proverbs 29:11 says, "A fool uttereth all her mind," may I add the "her" there, "but a wise person keepeth it till afterwards." Proverbs 18:2 says, "A fool does not delight in understanding, but only in revealing his own opinion." You know, so many times I feel like my opinion is so great and that it just, the whole world will suffer if I don't offer it. And I want everyone to know this great gem of truth, especially my husband. Talking too much. And then a sixth thing is resentment. Hebrews 12:15 talks about a bitter spirit, and unfortunately, ladies, we cannot keep a bitter spirit to ourselves. Hebrews 12:15. Resentment and bitterness. Now you notice that all of these have to do with our attitude. Attitude toward the Lord, toward His Word, toward mundane duties, toward our husband. Proverbs 14:1 says, every wise woman builds her own house, but the foolish one tears it down with her own hands. And ladies, if we are indulging in these things, we're simply tearing down our own house. Every wise woman builds her own house, but the foolish one tears it down with her own hands. In order to be loving, we have to work at the job of being sweethearts. Some of you have discovered that the reason the glow goes in marriage is because you didn't work at it. All you have to do for love to begin to be a withering flower is simply neglect it. You don't have to beat it. You don't have to do bad things. You just have to neglect it. It's like a tender flower that needs care, nourishment, watering, feeding. This is what love is. And we have to work at this job of being sweethearts. Now, isn't it strange that we so easily let that part of our marriage slip? Don't you remember what fun it was to be sweethearts? Wasn't the job of being sweethearts before you were married the most exciting part of your life? Then why do we let it slip? It's great work. And yet so often it does. Ruth Graham says that, or someone said that their motto of their marriage was sweethearts forever. And those who know them indicate that this is certainly true. And another thing Ruth said is that a good marriage is made up of two good forgivers. And I thought of Proverbs 17:9 in the Amplified. Along with that, it says, he who covers and forgives an offense seeks love. But he who repeats and harps on it separates even close friends. And we could put in there, separates a husband and a wife. Do I seek to cover and forgive an offense because I love him, or do I harp on it and repeat it so that we are separated? Do you see, ladies, what it does? Ephesians 5:33 in the Amplified has a good word to us on this, of being a loving companion. This is what it says a wife is supposed to do. Let the wife see that she respects and reverences her husband. And this is what this means, that she notices him, regards him, honors him, prefers him, venerates and esteems him, and that she defers to him, praises him, and loves and admires him exceedingly. Quite a list, huh? Now, didn't you think that that was what he was supposed to do to you? But the scripture says this is what a wife is to do. Makes a good prayer list, doesn't it? Check yourself and see, how am I doing today? And ladies, of course, if we treat our husbands this way, there will be no problem with having this kind of response to us and for us. Part of being loving is just to admire him. Your husband needs you to admire his manliness. Now the world tears down that which is his manliness. And ladies, he needs you as his wife to build it back up, and he needs you to admire his manliness. This book, Fascinating Womanhood, by Helen Andelin, has a good word on this matter of admiring his manliness. Now, some of us, you know, after you get past, you're glad that he, you know, he's big and strong and tall, and he has a broad chest and has a deep voice. Or, you know, you can't think of too many other manly things. But I think she has about 2 or 3 pages of things. So you ought to get the book just for those lists, you know, so that you can review them. But our husbands desperately need to hear this from us. This is the part of love that is very meaningful to them. And ladies, we need to tell our husbands these things. Sometimes we would like to think, well, they know it. they know it. Or some of you are, again, standoff because you say, well, he never tells me. I'm not going to tell him. Well, why don't you be the first to break the ice? And he needs to hear these things from you, because, ladies, if you don't tell him, somebody else will. Satan will see to that. Now, tied in both with number two, which we're on, and also this last one, being a sex partner, is this matter of being attractive. Are you staying as attractive as possible? I want you to know I'm so grateful that the trends in women's clothes are going back to femininity. I'm so tired of these manly clothes. I have a little suspicion in my mind about who designs clothes like that for women, what kind of people. And I'm so glad to see this feminine trend, because you see, your husband loves your femininity, because you see, it's a great contrast, and that in itself builds up his manliness. You know, he doesn't want a roommate. He doesn't want somebody that looks just like him. Viva la difference. You know, he loves the femininity that is you. What kind of clothes do you wear? Do you wear those nice, well, of course, down here in Florida you won't, but those nice, heavy, coarse tweeds, the very practical things, the long granny gowns. Up in the States where it's colder, the women always laugh when I mention granny gowns, and one lady wrote me a note in the question and answer period and said, well, what do you do to keep warm if you throw away your granny gowns? You can't have an electric blanket all year. And I said, just throw on an extra blanket, it'll be worth it. But if you have some old raggedy granny gown, I hope you'll tear it up for dust rags. And if you don't have money to get you something sweet and feminine, then pray about it. God will send the money in. But I think we have a responsibility in the matter of our weight, and this is my biggest battle, our hair, lingerie, the type of clothes we wear. Our husbands want us to be feminine. Now, cutting your hair so short that it looks like shorter than the men's are wearing today may be practical, but if you don't look feminine, ladies, it's not worth it. And I'm not against short hair. I wish I could wear it. I just want it to be feminine short hair. Do you see what I mean? Because your husband doesn't want you to look like him. He wants you to be a great contrast. Now, some of you would think your husband would never notice. He will. It may be a great shock to him, but he will notice. He may not say anything because he may be in a state of shock. But he will notice, and he will appreciate it. Now, you may have put him down in such a way that he wouldn't be eager to say anything. But if you just keep it up, it'll win the day. Do you ever dress up just for him? Friend said she was going out to lunch with the girls, and as she passed her husband, he said, oh, wow, I wish you'd dress up for me that way sometime. How about it about 5:30 at night? What do you look like? It's hard to stop then, isn't it? You're hanging over the hot stove, and the kids have been yelling and screaming and spilling stuff, and you've got it all down the front of you, and you just think, well, he'll have to understand. But it's very worthwhile to just take a minute to go in and freshen up and put on something that looks feminine, to serve that meal that you've already spilled all over everywhere. It'll mean a great deal to him to know that it was important enough to you just to look pretty for him. And this guards them against the temptation of the flesh. Friend husband says, why should I go after oleo when I have butter at home? The physical element is so important. It continues to be just as important in marriage as it was in courtship. And it was important in initiating love, and it's important in conserving love, preserving love. And some women make the mistake of assuming that the marriage contract means that their husbands have to remain attracted to them just by virtue of that. And of course, this is not true. Not at all. And if we do not remain lovely after marriage, don't you see it's rather like putting a pretty shiny apple on top of a barrel of rotten ones? It's a fraud, isn't it? If we dressed up before and showed them how pretty we could look to gain their attention, to gain their affection, and to marry them, and then let ourselves go and make no more effort. It was like a fraud, wasn't it? We need to keep this thing in focus of being attractive. Now, I don't say that a woman can be really attractive unless she's attractive in her soul, in her heart. 1 Peter 3:4 says that our beauty shouldn't be dependent on an elaborate hairdo or the wearing of jewelry or fine clothes, but on the inner beauty, the unfading loveliness of a calm and gentle spirit. And ladies, if all we have is a closet full of Neiman Marcus and nothing in the wardrobe of our soul, we're in sad shape. But it's a matter of balance, isn't it? To keep ourselves physically looking as attractive as possible while we're also keeping the wardrobe of our soul well stocked. Now the third thing is being queen of our household. And of course this is where the women's lib loves to attack the most. Helen Andelin, in her book Fascinating Womanhood, again says, this implies something more than a clean, orderly home, well-behaved children, and delicious meals. It relates to the woman herself, indicating a glory which she has added to the home, which causes her to appear as a goddess. She must be successful as a homemaker, of course, but beyond this accomplishment, she adds a light warmth and a spirit to her home, which adds a very special quality to her calling as a homemaker. It is homemaking on a celestial plane. Don't you like that? It is homemaking on a celestial plane. And such a woman is happy and content, and she radiates her happiness to others. And a man wants most of all for his woman to be happy, his wife to be happy in her role as a homemaker. To merely dust and sweep requires little intelligence and challenge. And my comment in here, too, is you can train chimpanzees to do that. You know, it doesn't take much intelligence. But it requires the gifts of the mind and the spirit to be a domestic goddess and to be the mother of men and create a haven of rest for our husbands. And you know, ladies, it's easier to be a good housekeeper than it is to be a good homemaker. This certainly is a different kind of glory than men enjoy. We don't get promoted to be vice president of the company, do we? And nobody notices too much, aside from our own husbands, what we do in our home. But it's a quiet, unacclaimed honor, and it's the way to rich fulfillment. And it certainly brings dignity to the role. Dr. Louis Evans says that a wife must see in the building of a home a very regal calling, a royal responsibility. It seems reasonable that a woman should approach the career of running a household with the same earnestness with which she expects her husband to approach the running of his business. It's a good thought, isn't it? We don't want them goofing off, do we? No, sir, not at all. Each should excel in his or her own realm of endeavor. And Proverbs 31 certainly indicates that this role of being queen of our household or a domestic goddess is a spiritual one as well as a physical one. Now, lastly, is the sex relationship. And I always leave this to last because then you see if time runs short, so nobody wants to go. Would y'all like to stand up for a minute? Would you like to stand up for a minute and stretch? You're going to need all you've got now to listen to this last part. I don't want anybody sleeping through it. Okay. Well, even though I've left it to last, it certainly is not the least in importance by any means. But this is the area in which, as women, we have so many problems. And it is so important in keeping love alive and keeping, the love relationship growing in marriage. And yet it's an area where there's so much lack of information and knowledge and misunderstanding. And many a marriage is goofed up in this area. Ladies, did you know that this part of marriage also has a message to proclaim? God has something special in this part of marriage. This one flesh relationship is to proclaim the intimacy of the relationship of Christ and the individual believer. Do you remember when he uses the illustration, he said, as I am one with the Father and the believer is one with me, and this tremendous oneness that Christ wants us to understand And then he talks about the oneness of the husband and the wife. He says, and the two shall become one. And it has a message to proclaim. Have you ever wondered what the Song of Solomon was doing in the Bible? Well, that's what it's doing. It's using the illustration of Solomon and his bride to illustrate the relationship of God or Christ and the believer. Be a great, there's a book called Union and Communion by Hudson Taylor, a little bitty book. It'd be wonderful to read with your husband. Thoroughly enjoy it. And it's on the Song of Solomon, Union and Communion by Hudson Taylor. Now, if this is such an important relationship, you can readily understand why God says that it should be hallowed and held within the bonds of marriage. And there's no other area, ladies, where we've gotten so mixed up. And the greatest hindrance to a woman enjoying this part of her married life is her attitude. Now, attitudes are influenced by many things, aren't they? And we bring to our marriage many wrong attitudes. Could be a lack of right information. It could be preconceived notions, old wives' fables. It could be a bad premarital sexual experience, which now has produced guilt or fear. Or it could be being molested as a child. All of these things have a bearing, because, ladies, you bring a composite of all of these attitudes, you see, with you into your marriage. Some of you are familiar with the book, several books written by Dr. Tim LaHaye. He's written this book on marriage, How to Be Happy Though Married. He's written The Spirit-Controlled Temperament. And now a new book, what is it called, Yvonne? Transformed Temperaments, on the same idea. Tim wrote in his book, How to Be Happy Though Married, sex education is 20% education and 80% attitude. The right attitude is important for both the husband and the wife. The first thing to recognize is that the act of marriage, that is intercourse, is good. It was designed by God for man's good. It could well be described as the most sublime expression of love between two people when limited to the bonds of marriage. Because of the fact that taboos are properly put on the act of marriage or intercourse during the teenage and courtship years, Christian girls sometimes hesitate to enter enthusiastically into this relationship after marriage. This is very true, isn't it? If we've been taught to keep our bodies holy to marriage, then sometimes it's very difficult for a girl to make that transition of one night I'm not married and the next night I am, and one night I shouldn't and the next night I should. And some girls never make the transition. They never see it as being a happy, holy, wonderful part of marriage. Tim goes on to say, sometimes because of preconceived ideas and false suggestions conveying an evil connotation, there is a subconscious association of guilt in fulfilling this act. Occasionally, a girl's viewpoint has been warped by a frustrated mother or grandmother whose sex life was unhappy, and she may secretly carry a feeling of dread to her marriage bed. These attitudes are contrary to God's plan. The only taboos in the sex relationship are outside the bonds of marriage. There is absolutely no connotation of evil involved in a proper relationship. Incidentally, I worked for Tim in Minneapolis in a church, and I would say he's well qualified to write on a happy marriage. He has a very lovely wife and family. Another book by H.J. Miles called Sexual Happiness and Marriage would be a very good one for you to get and read if this is a problem for you. So many of us have been brought up to think of sex as being very dirty, animalistic, worldly, unspiritual, degraded, forbidden. Or maybe your own experience of sex, even in marriage, has been so ghastly that you just can't imagine that it would be anything enjoyable, and certainly nothing sacred. Some of you may secretly think that you've married a sex maniac and he couldn't be nearly as spiritual as he claims to be because he's everlastingly thinking of only one thing. Well, he's probably quite normal. And let me tell you that one of the most spiritual things you could do is to be a relaxed, uninhibited, exciting sex partner. Marriage and sex were given by God as a gift to man and woman before sin ever entered the world. Had you ever thought about that?
That to me is a tremendous thought and should relieve a great deal of feeling that some have built up because of misinformation. Somewhere along the line, people have passed on the idea that it certainly wouldn't be too spiritual to really enjoy sex in your marriage. Sex and marriage were given as gifts of God to mankind before sin ever entered the world, and therefore it is not sin. A beautiful thought. Hebrews 13:4 says, the marriage bed is undefiled. Is God a liar? Of course not. And Genesis 18:12 has a very wonderful thought in it. This is where the angel came to Sarah and told her that she was going to bear a child. And Holly Hendricks pointed out that in the original, the word translated pleasure here, she says something, shall I have this pleasure of, I think in the, like the King James, it looks like pleasure in bearing a child, having another child. He says the original brings out the idea, shall I have sexual pleasure and arousal again? See, what she's saying is, I enjoyed this, and now here I am 99 years old, am I again going to enjoy this? Whoopee! Sarah enjoyed sex, and we ought to also. 1 Corinthians 6:15-20 is this portion of scripture that talks about our bodies being the temple of the Holy Spirit. And we usually think of this as in a negative sense, you know, that we aren't to use our bodies for anything then that would destroy the temple or pollute the temple of God. But you see, it also has the positive aspect. If it is God's temple, then we should use it as he pointed out in the Word of God. All right, it's evident from all of these scriptures that the only taboos in the sex relationship are outside the bonds of marriage. Another very interesting portion is 1 Corinthians 7, verses 3 through 5, where it talks about that the man doesn't have control over his body, nor the woman over hers, but each over the other. And then it says, do not defraud one another. And girls, I think this is a weapon that many a girl hangs on to and thinks this is my only defense, and I can wield this weapon and make him do whatever I want. If he's a good boy, I will give him my favors. If he is not, I withhold them. And in many areas, you may feel like you have no control over what's happening to you. And so you clutch at this one. And girls, according to the scriptures, this is sin. It says, defraud ye not one another. It said, unless you're going to go apart and fast and pray. And then it says, but come back together, lest Satan enter in. And if you're using it as a club or a tool or a weapon to get your own way, it's just plain sin. And God will not bless that attitude. Not one bit. Are you always the reluctant dragon? Are you always tired? You've got a stomachache or a headache or a toeache or something? It's very easy, isn't it? To always be the reluctant dragon. And sometimes you really are tired, aren't you? But you know, I find personally that when I just give myself to my husband in this way, tired or not, do you know I always come out just so much more refreshed? I'm not tired anymore. It's a great restore. Now, I don't say that there would never be a time, like Shirley Rice says, it's okay to miss a meal, but if you go on, fasting, you'll die. I don't mean that there's never a time, but I think women easily can fall into the habit of saying no for 100 false reasons. And God never meant it to be that way. Shirley Rice said that there are several consequences of ignoring our husband's needs in this area. One is that it's sin, because God has commanded us to meet this need, and therefore our own relationship with the Lord is in jeopardy if I'm involving myself in sin, you see. Secondly, our relationship with our husband can be damaged and even ruined. And thirdly, we tempt our husbands to sin, to anger, masturbation, and even adultery. And so it's a very serious matter. Now, maybe you're offended by or you don't understand your husband's caressing and fondling of her body. I think many of us came into marriage with so little information, and maybe we had some vague idea that intercourse was involved in this. But I think for many, the idea of the foreplay or caressing and fondling of the body was kind of a new thing, like this girl in college that got married and came back to tell us all the story, you know. And she said, talk about wandering hands. They're all over. And I thought at the time, ooh, ghastly. Well, she obviously didn't understand the whole purpose in this. And God has made this a part of the sexual act, not for our husband's benefit. They come to it ready. It's for our benefit. We're the ones that need to be heated up a bit. It's for our benefit and enjoyment. And maybe the thought of fondling or affectionately caressing your husband's body, or especially his genital organs, is an offensive thing to you. Maybe it seems wrong. Have you ever wondered, I don't know if anybody else does what we do. And I wonder if what we're doing is wrong. I bet you have. That's why you're laughing. Well, not so. It's not wrong if it's pleasurable and enjoyable to both of you. Whatever is a part of an expression of love between the two of you is not wrong if it's agreeable and pleasurable to both of you. Shirley Rice says, there is no part of the body that is improper to use, to caress with the lips, the tongue, or the hands. Anything is permissible as long as it is not offensive to either party and affords mutual pleasure and satisfaction. You would refrain from anything offensive to the other, though many inhibitions should be removed with the knowledge that this sort of lovemaking is holy and pleasing to God between man and wife. Now, maybe this relationship isn't too important to you in your marriage. Why not? Is it because you're not enjoying it? Is it because you don't have much desire? Is it because you're not climaxing in your relationship? Why aren't you enjoying it? Why isn't it important to you? I would say if it's any of those reasons, you should certainly get some help. Because it's important, first of all, because you don't know what you're missing if you're not enjoying it. You know, you're really missing out. And secondly, God's plan is that you desire it and enjoy it. God never meant for you just simply to endure it, like eating spinach or something, you know. He meant it to be a highest pleasure for you. And thirdly, it's mighty important to your husband and to God that you enjoy this relationship. And God can use this relationship of real unity to accomplish great things in a couple's life. And it could be that your attitude toward this part of your life is a stumbling block to your husband's spiritual growth. Have you ever thought about that? Proverbs 31:11, I think, is very significant in this. It says, the heart of her husband trusts in her confidently and relies on and believes in her safely so that he has no lack of honest gain nor need for dishonest spoil. Now, if you're giving him honest gain at home, he won't be looking for dishonest spoil. You see, it's a protection against lust becoming an overwhelming problem to him. It's a problem to any man. But it can be a tool in Satan's hand, or it can drive him to the Lord, one or the other. And if we're keeping him satisfied at home, then it won't be an overwhelming problem to him. You know, love always wants to give, and it looks for a way of expressing itself. And this is one of the deepest expressions of love and oneness that we're capable of. And love sees sex as an interaction and communion of the total personality. It's not a physical thing alone. This is why when girls sleep with many, many fellas, they find that later they are a fragmented personality. Because you see, you kind of leave a part of yourself. Because God meant that this act be an act of our total personalities. Not just body, but body, soul, and spirit. Body and emotions and spirit. It's our whole personality expressing love. Some time ago, I had this thought that was very precious to me, and then I read it in Tim's book, and I found out he knew it all along. I thought it was my brand new idea, and I just loved it, and I still do, even though Tim thought of it first. And I'd like to share it with you in closing. Happy is the woman who looks upon the act of marriage or intercourse as a means of showing her love for her husband and of his showing his love for her. In a vital sense, it may be the only single experience that she and her husband have together in which they do not have to share each other with any other single person. If she is a good cook, her husband may have to share her culinary arts with friends. If he is a good storyteller, she must also share this ability with their friends. The same goes for their appearance, manners, courtesies, and practically every other area of life. If they happen to be in the ministry or in some way where they're counseling with a lot of people all the time, you share them day in, day out with the telephone and with people. But the act of marriage is unique, and that it is the one experience from which they exclude the whole rest of the world. Isn't that a precious thought to you? This is the one area where we do not have to share them with anyone else. Let me just give you some final thoughts to chew on. 1 Peter 3:7 talks about being heirs together of the grace of life. And then it talks about that your prayers be not hindered. And girls, if our home is not scripturally regulated according to the way God has set it out to be, this could be responsible for unanswered prayers. Maybe you've wondered why some prayer hasn't been answered. Could this be it? It says that your prayers be not hindered. And then Howie Hendricks talks about, he said, if you want to know if you're under the Spirit's control, don't check your ministry. Check your home. And he said, it's no mistake that in Ephesians 5, Paul starts talking about, you know, don't be filled with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. Then right after that, he starts talking about home relationship. And he says, check it, test it at the home level. How are you doing at that level? And if it doesn't work in the family, don't export it. Pray. Father, I pray that you would take the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart and make it acceptable to you. And I pray, Lord, that you would write upon each girl's heart that which you want her in particular to remember. And Father, for some reason it seems that it's been difficult to communicate today. But I trust you with this because we committed it to you. And I ask, Lord, that you would just make this so special to each heart because it's something that's dear to you. And I pray that we would go out of here ready to be a better wife, a better woman, a better person, a better mother. And Lord, that you would give us the heart to work on these areas of weakness, that we would be to the praise of your glory. And I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.